Everybody, please be seated. This is case number 55544, State Department of Corrections versus Lindstrom. Ms. Trout for the appellant, Mr. McKenna for the respondent. Ms. Trout.
Good morning. I'm Janet Trout, Senior Deputy Attorney General, and I'm representing the State of Nevada Department of Corrections this morning. I'll be referring to them as the NDOC, and I would like to reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal, please. Mm-hmm. May it please the court. The hearing officer in this case unilaterally changed the burden of proof for personnel hearings by requiring that any employee who is interviewed by the Department of Personnel's Sexual Harassment Unit must be compelled to give testimony at a personnel appeal hearing where the investigation is used as the basis for employee discipline. This is unsupported in the law. You should reverse today because of the errors by both the reviewing judge and the hearing officer. Your reversal will preserve the right and duty of state agencies to discipline their employees appropriately using the law of public employees provided by statute, regulation, and policy.
Who had the burden at the agency level?
Well, at the agency level, at the appeal hearing, it's a very different kind of setup because although the employee is seeking an appeal of the discipline against him, the burden is on the department. But the reviewing standard there is to see whether the department was reasonable in their determination. It's not a hearing to rehash the investigation or the facts. It's based on what the appointing authority was presented with, and presented with that evidence, did they make the right decision?
Why have a hearing if you're just going to base it on a report? Why bother? Well, just submit the report, save a lot of time, save a lot of money.
Well, because the report is there, and there is an opportunity, and it has to do with process, and it's not incumbent on the state to bring those people who were interviewed by the sexual harassment unit. However, the employee still has an opportunity to call those witnesses, and that's his choice.
But it was your agency's ability to come and sustain its burden by presenting the investigative officer who elected not to be available for the hearing. I mean, let's be fair here. It isn't that the hearing officer said you must bring every single employee whom the investigating officer spoke to. The hearing officer said, I've read your report and I've listened to Mr. Lindstrom or Dr. Lindstrom, and I find this was unreasonable.
Well, Justice Pickering, I think that the issue there really is that investigator was not available. She's a state employee. She has a right to request her annual leave. She did that. And the Department of Corrections sought a subpoena from the hearing officer. The hearing officer issued the subpoena, and the subpoena was appropriately served. It was a valid subpoena. And so it brings us to the issue about the continuance. The continuance for the Department of Corrections in a personnel hearing is pursuant to 284.786. And there's a specific rule that says continuances are to be granted if good cause is shown. And so we...
Is a vacation good cause?
Pardon?
Is a vacation good cause? A vacation.
I think it is. When a state employee has requested annual leave and booked travel before that happens, before the subpoena is issued or served, and she hasn't done it intentionally, she has a right to do that. And this is a case that went on for a period of time. There were lengthy negotiations. The hearing was not finally scheduled at this point until approximately a year after the termination took place. At that point in time, it isn't going to be an issue. It's an insignificant change. And factually, I think if Mr. Linder, counsel below for the Department of Corrections, had sought enforcement of the subpoena, it would have had to have gone to district court, and it probably would have been held up for a year. What was expedient under the rules was for continuance to be granted so that she could appear.
Could you give me a timeline of when the hearing was scheduled? And by that, I mean the date people knew when it was going to be scheduled, then the date the witness made her vacation plans, then the date of the subpoena, then the date of the continuance request.
I don't have all of that information, Your Honor, and that's because the investigator works for the Department of Personnel. And the way the process is set up is that the agencies are required to use the investigator at the sexual harassment unit for all of their investigations of sexual harassment or discrimination. And that builds in an objective quality, that they don't know the players. It's independent. The Department of Corrections doesn't control her annual leave.
But I understand those points. What I'm trying to do is just understand the timeline of when was the hearing set, when was the subpoena issued, when was the motion for continuance made?
I believe that the hearing was set sometime in December for February. I don't have in my head the details of when the subpoena was served, but I can
do that
for you on rebuttal.
Yeah, I think the reason, Ms. Trout, we were interested in that, the hearing was on February 12th of 2009, and Mr. Short, the hearing officer, indicated that the motion to continue was denied because of the lateness of the request. So probably when I guess your office found out that the Ms. Sullivan had other plans and paid for it or whatever, it kind of may be germane to that issue. And I'm sure it's in the record somewhere.
Well, I believe that within a day or two of finding that Ms. Sullivan was not available, that's when the motion was done. So the motion was made timely based on when counsel for the NDOC knew that there was an issue with her attendance.
When was, though, Ms. Sullivan notified by your office that this hearing had been set for February 12th? I mean, that would be the key.
I don't know that information. And honestly, I looked through the file. I couldn't find that, and it may have been an old email. We're talking about March of 2008. But I'd like to get back here to the findings and recommendations that weren't provided by the hearing officer in this case. And that's fatal to the case. We know that the weight of evidence is going to be entitled to deference on judicial review. But if there are no findings, to what are we applying deference? Everything that the hearing officer said was, I'm dismissing this because you didn't bring these complaining witnesses. There's nothing that talks about any other purpose or reason why he made a decision. Now, we know that in a case, the judge is going to retain jurisdiction over any order in the case until there's a final order issued in the case and it's entered. There essentially is no final order in this case. We can't go back and conjecture what the hearing officer wrote in response to the original motion to dismiss, what the hearing officer said on the record in the small hearing that was held, none of those things, because the judge is always at will to change what the final order is. And we have that in our case law. The order isn't final until it's written. And even a spoken order issued from the bench concluding a case can be changed. So what do we know? All we know is that issue about whether we got there and whether those witnesses were required. And a lot of that is based on the characterization of the evidence as hearsay. NRS 284.390 paragraph 4 clearly says for personnel hearings, technical rules of evidence do not apply. In that setting, it's actually an error by the attorney to even make an objection that's based on hearsay. Look at the standard of evidence. It's set out in the NAC specifically. 284.794 says evidence shall be relevant And that's basically it.
Is double hearsay permitted in this type of proceeding?
Essentially, any evidence is available because the technical rules of evidence don't apply. And so whether it's hearsay or it's second level or third level, it doesn't matter. And if there's an objection, 284.794 says that we're going to look at two factors, competence and relevance. That's it. Frankly, we don't get to any of the case law applicable there. We don't get to Bigler. Bigler actually is distinguished in this case. It's based on a California statute that says the hearing doesn't have to be conducted according to the technical rules of witnesses and evidence. But if you're going to use hearsay, it has to be to corroborate or to further explicate the testimony. The law in issue here just says technical rules of evidence do not apply at the hearing. We don't have that additional issue.
What event triggers the 30-day time period to request judicial review, though, like that? Do you have to have the written findings, or is it the hearing date or in your experience? How does that work exactly?
Well, I think that the actual termination date, and that's set by the due process under 284.656. So you have the draft specificity of charges is issued, and it gives a 10 working day requirement.
But once the hearing's held the decision is made, now if it were a district court case, as you know, you'd have to have a written order and a notice of entry, and then you have 30 days to appeal to the Supreme Court. What's the equivalent timeline to go to file a petition for judicial review in district court? And what documents do you need to be able to go forward?
Well, generally, we see conclusions of fact, findings of fact, conclusions of law, and decision. In this case, it was the order dismissing the appeal. And that is actually interesting because since Mr. Lindstrom filed the appeal himself, his request to dismiss would actually reinstate the termination. I have gone beyond my time.
I want to save your 3 minutes.
Thank you.
Mr. McKenna, on behalf of the respondent.
Thank you. And Justice Pickering, and I know our dates are in the brief, the opposition brief that we replied our answer, but I'll just go over them real quickly. We originally had the motion to dismiss, and then in November 6th, the matter is set for the hearing of January 8th. So November 6th, everybody knows we're going to have a hearing January 8th. On December 8th, that gets continued to February 12th.
Why was it continued?
I don't recall, probably by agreement, conflict of schedule. So now we know it's going to be February 12th, and that's, in fact, when it occurred. The continuance for this missing witness was filed on February 7th, 5 days prior. The representations made at the time was that this individual had booked a prepaid vacation back in January. So obviously someone hadn't informed her, or she didn't care, that this court date was coming up and that she was considered a witness for the state. So the whole continuance issue was certainly dealt with by the hearing officer. By May, say he was upset about the last-minute continuance. This case had dragged on for a very long period of time. There had previously been a motion to dismiss. That's what happened back in November. We filed, employee filed a motion to dismiss based on inadequate evidence. We went over it. It came that close to being dismissed at that time, and it was said, we will have the hearing, you will bring your witnesses, and we'll see how it comes out. I will weigh the evidence. So everybody was on notice that this February 12th was going to be the day to put on the show.
Does the motion to continue state when in January the Sullivan made the vacation plans?
You know, I don't recall it referring to a specific date. I have the general knowledge during the verbal discourse.
And I'd like record knowledge only, so.
I'm sorry?
I'm only interested in record knowledge.
Yes. I just know it was only a few days before the hearing. So the hearing officer certainly made a correct ruling not to continue based on that. Even more importantly, really, even if they could have gotten the benefit of the doubt and said, well, you know, continue this out a couple months. It's been continued. Let's get this witness in here. I could have accepted that, obviously. However, the truth of the matter is this witness is an investigator who interviewed a dozen people and wrote a very comprehensive report, a multi-page report quoting what all these various individuals had to say. That investigator never had any firsthand knowledge whatsoever to contribute in the way of testimony. Basically, that investigator could have came to the hearing and said, this is my report, and what it says is what I heard, and I wrote it down accurately. That's it. Nothing beyond the content of the report could have been provided by this witness. The report itself came into evidence, and the hearing officer had it and used it in terms of his weighing of the evidence and making his decision. Now, of course, in addition, and the hearing officer pointed it out, and you've alluded to it this morning, the 12 people who were interviewed were the firsthand witnesses. They had firsthand testimony. They certainly were all available. There was no representation that they were all on vacation. And any one or more of them could have come in and testified as to what they said in the report and even elaborated on it, obviously, if necessary, and could have been cross-examined. None of those witnesses were brought to the hearing of February 12th, so there was no firsthand witnesses provided. Their claim that the investigator, they needed continuance based on the investigator, basically authenticating the report, didn't carry any weight with the hearing officer. Ultimately, he listened to the testimony of his Mr. Helling, or maybe, excuse me if it's Dr. Helling, who was the administrative head of the agency, and he testified about his concerns and how this affected the agency. My client testified that the matter in the hearsay document that was in evidence, that he disputed it and disagreed with it. And ultimately, the hearing officer ruled a couple of different things. Number one, I take the hearsay evidence. So this statement that hearsay evidence was rejected is just not true. The report was in evidence. He read it and he weighed it. And he ended up saying, in effect, the complaints made in that statement, that multi-page 12-person statement, are things people shouldn't do. Shouldn't call people names. You shouldn't make derogatory comments toward them. But I don't see them on their face as actually being sexual harassment. That was his call, his judgment. He didn't have any additional testimony from the witnesses who might have elaborated or under examination expanded their
testimony.
Do you
disagree with your opponent's characterization of the burden being on NDOC, but the inquiry being whether their decision on the facts given was unreasonable? Or is it a time to reopen the facts that were given? And let's say, for example, one of the witnesses says that this defendant was outrageous in his fondling of somebody, and he didn't. There's no evidence of that, but take it for a hypothetical.
Right.
And then that same witness comes to the hearing and says, you know, I made that stuff up. I don't like this guy. At that point, is the hearing officer judging what NDOC had in its mind when it disciplined the employee? And so the repudiation of that accusation is irrelevant to the hearing officer, or is it relevant to the hearing officer's reasonableness determination? Do you see my question?
I do see your question, and I find it very intriguing and very interesting. I'm certainly glad it's not part of this case, because that could be a little wrinkle that could create a question of the information they had at the time, and they made a decision based on it. Was that a reasonable decision? The information changes at the hearing officer level, so is he allowed to go, oh, because the information changed, it's a bad decision? Or does he have to say, well, your decision was reasonable based on what you knew, and it's too bad she was a liar?
Yeah, exactly. What's your position on the scope of review at that point, legally?
It's not something I've looked into or pondered. I can give you my gut feeling that says if someone repudiates, that's critical information. And certainly when an employee's job is at issue, I would think the hearing officer should have some ability then to say, well, what you did was reasonable at the time, but now we know what you based it on is not true, so I can't let your reasonable decision stand on false grounds. Seemed to me there would have to be a repair that could occur there. Although I
or maybe that the investigation was inadequate in the first place.
Yeah, in this case, that's what we have. We have an investigation in which the hearing officer has determined he doesn't have the smoking gun fondling or sexual conduct that just on its face says, oh, this is sexual harassment. In fact, he finds the opposite, that on its face, I don't find sexual harassment.
Well, he doesn't go that far.
Well, he goes far enough to say that he didn't think it was a valid reason to sustain the reasonableness of the termination, which was his job. My basic position, or what I determined to be the state's position in this case is, and I know they're in a difficult spot, I'll grant them that. It's no fun to argue something where you really had nothing to argue. Their basic position is that they made a decision, they did an investigation, their interpretation of the facts can't be altered, their interpretation of the law as it applies to the facts can't be altered, and a hearing officer must just affirm their decision. It's what Justice Cherry just raised, that why have the hearing? You know, if what you say is you made a good investigation, your facts are the facts, they can't be disputed, and we applied the law and we're telling you how the law applies to the facts, and so we're right, it's over. Well, that isn't the way it works. And it certainly doesn't work at the hearing officer level, who has a job to weigh the evidence and determine whether the employee is being treated fairly. It doesn't work at the district court level, when he had to look at what the hearing officer did.
Well, Judge Russell looked at this and wrote an order, a decision in this matter, and he certainly thought that the hearing officer was correct in this matter.
Yeah, and so they've had that opportunity as well, and now, of course, they're here. And the essence of their position is the hearing officer can't overrule us, has to defer to us. The judge should have deferred to us, and now you're being asked to defer to us. And, you know, my school of thought is that's exactly the opposite of why we have hearing officers, judges, and Supreme Courts. So, you know, unless you have other questions, I think our brief is pretty clear.
I do have one. Let's say the employer finds, I mean, sexual harassment, hostile work environment are not litmus test issues. There's a bit of beauty is in the eye of the beholder and perception going on there, and the people who work shoulder to shoulder with someone give an account to an investigator, and they say, this was just intolerable. I can't point to specific acts, but I felt threatened by this person, sexually harassed, whatever, ephemeral. The agency makes the decision based on that, that it adds up in its estimation to a hostile work environment that they need to correct. They make that decision, it goes to the hearing officer. Is the hearing officer entitled to say, no, that was an unreasonable inference from those facts? Is that the point of the hearing in answer to or follow-up to Justice Cherry's question, that the hearing officer then reevaluates the inference of hostile workplace or not hostile workplace?
I certainly think that's implicit in his duty to decide whether the employer was reasonable. So how do you decide someone is reasonable? You have to weigh the facts that they had against their decision-making process. So if the facts they had, they call outrageous, terrible, the worst thing we've ever seen, we're going to turn. And you look at that and you say, well, that's kind of unreasonable. The facts are not nice, but they're not to the degree that you're claiming they're to be. I think you're unreasonably deciding what these facts mean or what these facts make. So, yes.
And then the courts give deference to the hearing officer at that point.
Yes. And then this court gives deference to the court, to the hearing officer, to all the way down the line. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. McKenna. Ms. Trout?
And I, if I may, since I have a half a minute, it's a pleasure to see you.
See all of you.
Ms. Trout? You have 3 minutes and 5 seconds.
Thank you, Your Honor. there's an error, again, in the assessment. If we say that the Banks case is going to be effective and we're going to apply District Court Rule 14, which is unreasonable, we're not in district court, we're in a personnel hearing. But you have to evaluate the witnesses there. In fact, Ms. Sullivan was more like an expert witness in this case. She was an investigator for the Sexual Harassment Unit of the Department of Personnel. At the hearing, she could have testified about the relevant training she had, the procedures that were in place for her to do the questioning. She could have testified about the fact that the witnesses there were not complaining witnesses. They were compelled to be there. Under the NDOC's policies and procedures, they must participate in an investigation. And if they didn't go and be interviewed, they could be subject to discipline themselves. Other things were about the affect of witnesses. Did they show up? Were they timid? Were they apologetic or embarrassed? Were they self-righteous and assured? All of those things talk about the veracity, and the only test in a personnel hearing for evidence on objection is whether it's competent and relevant. And this evidence was here. I think we have evidence that's in the record that the hearing officer made an error in how he weighted that, and his prejudice was shown. He called it not only hearsay, double hearsay. He offered it was triple hearsay. That was not his job. The statutory requirement of what the review is, if we look at Chapter 284, 390 says the employee can request a hearing, an appeal of his termination, after he's had due process. The pre-disciplinary hearing under 656 is where the employee gets to say, I think they're telling a lie. That's there. The appeal hearing is to appeal. Well, I put that evidence there. You didn't believe me. That's something different. The state isn't required to do that. The Supreme Court in the Richardson v. Perales case said that hearsay is sufficient. It is sufficient. There's no exclusion. The court below in that case got it wrong. You don't exclude it. You give it its full weight. We have evidence here that it didn't happen. And we never got there. The whole posture of this case looks like it was only about sexual harassment. There were 10 separate charges. There was a safety and security violation. We're talking about the mental health unit.
Well, if it was such an important case, why didn't they bring a witness in besides this woman? Besides
the state did not need those witnesses to put on their case. And those witnesses are going to be entitled to some kind of protection. They're serving the state. They were compelled to bring their testimony. Some of them were victims. Some of them were witnesses of the sexual harassment. But there's no requirement that the state put those people through a hearing. It's not required.
So you're putting the burden on the person who was terminated to subpoena all these people and they haven't come forward. Then what are you going to try to quash the subpoenas? On what basis?
Well, actually, Your Honor, pursuant to 284.718, those reports and their testimony are in the rules as confidential, and then there's a procedure whereby the hearing officer can release that information, and that was all bypassed here.
Well, I think you need to go to the legislature and tell them, you know what, we don't need a hearing officer anymore, let's just do reports and let things go as they may. I think a hearing officer also makes a judgment on credibility. How could he do anything on credibility here? No witnesses came forward.
Well, and that's correct, because the hearing officer had in his authority to make sure that the investigator could be present to testify about that, and she was denied that hearing. The governor's policy on sexual harassment requires agencies to use the investigator of the state sexual harassment unit and to base their discipline on that report that they get.
No, the hearing, that's unfair. The hearing officer would have heard Ms. Sullivan had she attended the hearing, and she could have spoken to the timidity of the witnesses, their anxiety. She could have given a full account of their affect, and that would not have been hearsay in the least.
Right.
She could have orally given that. So it isn't as if the hearing officer compelled all 12 witnesses that she interviewed to come forward. The problem lay in her not being there.
Right, and she was not available, and the NDOC could not do anything but serve the subpoena on her. And that was the hearing officer's province.
So we're back to the continuance.
Yes.
Yeah, I understand. You're in a hard position, and I'm just trying to nail this down.
And, you know, the law that is listed here, there were many cases that were referred to 233B. The only thing that a personnel hearing uses 233B for is the judicial review. There are specific statutes and regulations that have the force and effect of law, and those govern personnel hearings. The personnel hearings are meant to be able to provide an employee to come in and represent themselves without having to bear the cost of counsel. And if we impose all these technical rules about this happened and this happened and this happened, and frankly, Your Honor, if there had been an issue the other way with a similar witness being unavailable by the other party, the state would have stipulated to it. You know, that's fair. It is for good cause. You know, we're not talking about an individual who's working
for the state. A prepaid vacation is not good cause. A prepaid vacation is not good cause, in my mind. I'm just telling you that.
Well, you know, Your Honor,
I had a prepaid vacation to Hawaii and I couldn't go, and believe me, I worked it out. It gets worked out.
Well, I understand that, Your Honor, but, you know, we're also talking about a classified employee in the state service. She, you know, there aren't resources. We're placing a burden on her, and she has a right to use her annual leave time.
Why, sure, when our legislators who decide that our employees are furloughed and our employees get a pay cut to know that somebody went on a cruise or whatever instead of testifying in a personnel hearing where somebody was terminated for sexual harassment and hostile work environment. That's just my feeling.
Well, I appreciate that view, Your Honor, but the hearing officer then had authority to see that the valid subpoena that he issued was enforced. Yeah. And that was missing. And the Department of Corrections didn't have authority to do that on their own.
And I know if you handled this case, you certainly would have called some witnesses. I know you would have, because you're better than what happened in the hearing.
Well, I don't know that, Your Honor. I think that the Supreme Court says that hearsay is substantial evidence in the administrative forum, and that's where we are. And all of those questions, the prejudice of the hearing officer is there on the record. Everything that the reviewing judge wrote in the order was conjecture. And you'll look at it. There are errors of law. He refers to Chapter 233. It doesn't apply here. Chapter 284, continuance for good cause, look at evidence to see whether it bears on the matter at hand and it's relevant. On appeal, on objection, is it competent and relevant? That's it. All of this stuff about excluding a witness, it doesn't apply. It's not on point. We're in the wrong forum. It would be the same thing if I were here before you saying, well, we have to follow the rules of Nevada civil procedure. We throw out the appellate rules. We don't use the rules interchangeably. And the state has an expectation that when they go to hearing, that's what they're going to be faced with and what they're going to apply. The hearing officer was in error in doing it, and we never, ever got to the deference that was there. A security violation was charged, and that entitles the state to deference as a matter of law. It's in the NAC, in a program that has safety and security policies. The appointing authority is entitled to deference. And Dredge points that up. You don't have to have an accident. You don't have to have a manifest security violation, only if it concerns security. Under these
please
facts,
wrap up. You're over 21 minutes.
Yes,
please.
Sorry. But that safety and security violation isn't addressed at all. And the deference is there. required to be given. It's the law of the state, and the hearing officer ignored it, and so did the reviewing judge. And so we respectfully request that both of the hearing officer and the district judge be reversed and that the termination be reinstated of Mr. Lindstrom.
In other words, you want us to make the findings of fact. We're going to read the report. Justice Pickering and Justice Gibbons and I are going to read the report, and we're going to decide whether this person should be terminated.
No,
that's what you just said.
No, Your Honor. The state made that decision. We're only asking that the required legal deference to that decision be granted. We've heard from counsel that all of these things were considered. It wasn't written in the order, so you don't know what the findings are, but they were all considered. And so when you look at the deference that's required by law, the only thing that you can do is reverse and reinstate the termination. Thank you.
Thank you for the spiritedness on both sides. I appreciate the argument, and this matter will stand submitted, and good seeing all counsel in this matter.
All right. When recess.